200 contaminants in the lower Fraser River, as well as fish tissue collected in the same area. These contaminants pose potential major risks for the river's juvenile Chinook salmon populations, as well as other aquatic life. Some of the contaminants in the study include antidepressants, blood pressure medications, caffeine, and even cocaine. A shocking discovery, but it's hard to know the severity of these findings without more context from the researchers involved. To learn more about the study, what these findings mean for Chinook salmon, and what can be done to address this issue, CJSF reached out to the senior author of the study, Tanya Brown, for a conversation. Tanya Brown is an ecotoxicologist and assistant professor of marine ecotoxicology at SFU. The first question we asked her was, as an ecotoxicologist, were these findings shocking to you?
Knowing the body of research and other bodies of work that have been done elsewhere, I wouldn't say it was shocking to me. It is sort of what I would have expected to find. But what's shocking to me, I guess the shocking part, is that we are finding these chemicals in our waterways, right? And this is what we're exposing, you know, important prey, not only for our marine mammal species, but also for humans. And so what we're exposing what we're consuming, you know, we are consuming Chinook salmon as well as many other salmonid species. So just thinking about it in that context as well. Yes, we were looking at juvenile Chinook. So what you would measure, say, in a juvenile Chinook relative to an adult Chinook could look very different. But it's not just looking from it from that lens. We're looking at it, what is the quality, how are we setting up these young Chinook salmon for entering their kind of their marine rearing life stage that they go out to sea for, you know, 4 years and then return back to spawn in their natal stream. So are we even setting them up for success to even make it through their first year out at sea, right? So I'm looking at it from that lens. And then I'm looking at it from the lens of being like, wow, you know, okay, maybe I'm not overly surprised with what we detected, but it's very alarming in and of itself, right? And to just think about, you know, they're basically swimming in a cocktail of chemicals continuously while they're out migrating, and this is all being discharged and into our oceans, right? So I think thinking about it from that lens, then it's, you know, that's sort of the concerning and shocking side of things.
And like you had mentioned, it has like a ripple effect because these salmon are also the main prey for other species as well. And that's going to have an effect just on like the larger ecosystem as a whole.
Exactly, exactly. And this is just, you know, contaminants is just one of many stressors that Chinook and other Pacific salmon populations are having to navigate and deal with, right? And so it's just thinking about it from that lens and perspective, just the cumulative risks that the cumulative threats that are imposed on them at such a young life stage is concerning.
Mm-hmm. How do things such as like antidepressants or caffeine or any of these sort of contaminants like end up in the waterways?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, there's so many. If you look, I don't know anybody who's flown into YVR into Vancouver, but you always fly in, you're looking over the Fraser River. So there's just in the lower Fraser River, it's, you know, lots of industry, obviously heavily urbanized area, so stormwater runoff. Every time it rains, there's a volume of chemicals that are, you know, with that rainwater is also carrying a number of contaminants, whether it's hydrocarbons from our streets, tire associated chemicals, pesticides from agricultural runoff. All of this would be coming into the Fraser River. And then also into our lower flowing tributaries that also flow into the Fraser River, where they would be expected to be at even higher concentrations. And these are also really important salmon rearing areas. So I think, you know, it's industry. So those are our point sources, non-point sources. We're more thinking about the agricultural runoff that I mentioned, wastewater treatment effluent, number of wastewater treatment plants all along the lower Fraser, So there's just a number of sources coming in.
Now, I know this was a bit past the scope of the study, but looking at the data that was collected, one of the main thoughts that came into my head is what can even be done about this? Or what should be done about this? And I'm wondering if you have any perspective on that to share.
Yeah, I think my hope, going into this study was to one is to bring about awareness, for the general public, but for the scientific community of and it's what we painted, detecting over 200 chemicals. This is There are far more chemicals in that system than what we detected. That's just we went out and we tried to measure as many possible chemicals as possible that are that. But there, if you look at in Canada, we have over 3,200 high volume use chemicals that are used in production in this country. And so we just don't have the capacity or the analytical capacity to measure those. So this, it's this 200 is there's much more that is that these salmon are being exposed to. And so when I'm thinking about that, one thing is just one to draw awareness, in terms of what are we detecting out there, but the context of what we put it in this research that we did was it's one thing to detect a chemical or pollutant, but it's another to relate that to risk. So we were looking at it in terms of the toxicity. So every chemical has a different toxicity. And so what I mean by that is a chemical toxic at different concentrations? And so that's where the kind of the ranking or the prioritization came in of how we said, well, these ones are the kind of the priority ones. So it's really what we thought these ones are what we're putting forward as these 16 chemicals as priority chemicals that we feel strongly are likely posing a risk to Chinook salmon as well as other aquatic biota in the Fraser River. And then we had other ones, 23 other contaminants, where we were like, these are watch list compounds that we want to flag as for future monitoring and that should be assessed. So you're kind of coming back to your question of, well, what can we do? I think one, the awareness, two, for authorities like our chemical regulators, just to be mindful of how can we now turn off the tap of getting these chemicals. Finding ways and being creative and innovative of how can we, look for improving even wastewater discharge. Are there other innovative ways that can, or reducing stormwater runoff and cleaning up that stormwater runoff before it's entering our salmon-bearing streams, as well as agricultural runoff. So I think there's a lot of, we have the capacity to improve a lot in that area.
It was interesting, like hearing you speak about the different like priorities given to different contaminants or chemicals, depending on like their severity. I guess are there some where that's sort of not even known yet what how that could be affecting salmon?
And I think there's, what we don't know is probably much larger than what we do know. So that's another scary aspect about the number of chemicals that are actually in our environment, right? So when we set on this large endeavor to try to find all the kind of we call them thresholds essentially. So studies that have gone out and looked at does this chemical cause an effect in, say, fish or other aquatic biota? And then you're comparing that to the actual concentrations that you're measuring in either the water or the tissue. What we, there was a rather short list of chemicals that we could actually do that for, if you're thinking in the context of the broader list that we were even able to measure. And so that's why we used a number of different approaches. So it's a great question that you have. The short answer is that, we need to catch up on the science in terms of identifying the risk that a lot of these compounds that pose to aquatic biota and humans as well. You always have to put it in the context. So everything we eat has contaminants, right? Because and I think, but there's a lot of other aspects about the food, the quality of our foods, kind of outweigh the exposure to those compounds and to those chemicals. So you have to think about it in kind of a few different lenses, if you will. And so, even when we're thinking about, important food items like salmon, just the nutritional value and quality kind of exceeds a lot of the exposure that, say, that humans would be exposed to. And what we were measuring, we were looking at juvenile Chinook. So most people are obviously eating adult Chinook, so very different chemicals that we would, the levels would look very different in an adult Chinook versus a juvenile Chinook. And so, and even, when I'm looking at it from a toxicologist perspective, my concern will be coming, I'll be at higher concern, say, for pharmaceuticals or current use pesticides and the impacts they might have on juvenile Chinook over, say, in the adult Chinook. We're more concerned about more of those bioaccumulative, and what I mean are contaminants that accumulate in the fat tissue or muscle tissue of an organism over time as they age. But also, when you get into a marine food web, as you feed higher in a trophic level, say for like example, our killer whales, they feed very high on they feed high in the trophic level, and so those marine mammals are exposed to much higher concentrations of these types of contaminants that tend to accumulate more in fat tissue as well as muscle tissue. So, yeah, just thinking about it in that context as well. But I think just coming back to you always have to, there's the cost and the benefits, right? And so, yeah, just putting that in that perspective. And we can look at, we are, there has been work from past work that are, my group as well as others, just looking at at how contaminated different salmonid species are, or even different populations of Chinook salmon. So there, you can look at it from that perspective as well.
So yeah, it's very multifaceted, a lot of nuance
Yes.
in measuring the contaminants and toxicity of certain salmonids, as you said.
Come on. Yeah. So, yeah, salmon species.
Yes. That, I believe, was all the time that I had for this interview. But if there was anything that we didn't touch on that you would like to mention or speak about, or you think is an important takeaway for this study for people to know about, what would that be?
I think just that, the Fraser is not, is not, it's unique in that, it's one of Canada's, it was once our, the largest salmon bearing, river, but it's not unique in the sense of, and it comes back to kind of your first question, was I surprised to find these 200 contaminants that we detected, or were we surprised? And I think, anywhere we look, whether we're looking in the Great Lakes or even south of the border in Washington State, it's not unique in that we would expect to find a lot of these compounds and even more compounds if we had the ability to detect them and measure them in our freshwater systems, right? And in our ocean. And so just, I think just being mindful of what we're exposing, of what is in our environment, right? And then putting the pressure on regulators and in terms of how can we turn off the tap on these contaminants.
Once again, that was our conversation with ecotoxicologist Tanya Brown on a recent research study out of SFU that found over 200 contaminants in the Lower Fraser River that are currently affecting juvenile Chinook salmon populations. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to Danny for that piece here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. I'm Jesse. And now time for a little bit more music. This is, the record A Party in Your Name by Hillsborough is out now. I've been playing the lead singles for it in the weeks that have preceded this one, and now it's out. I'm very excited about that. It came out on Friday. This track is from that record. You can get it now on Bandcamp and places where you stream music. It's called E-Girls for President.
You're listening to CJSF.
This is Nicole Hines with CJSF 90.1 FM, and I'm here with Fake Knot artistic director, choreographer, and performer Ralph Escamillan to chat about the world premiere of My House, which is a performance celebrating ballroom culture, familiar bond, and love and support. So, Ralph, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I am so good. The sun is shining in these Lower Mainland streets, so I'm very happy to see it.
People are out today.
They are out today. They were out yesterday too, so I'm here for it. Okay, so my first question to you, I really, really want to get into talking about My House.
Yeah, so My House is a new project under my company, Fake Knot. I'm a dance company based in the city, really focused on costume, textile, and the body in the last few years. And I'm also a founder of the pioneer of the Vancouver ballroom Kiki scene.
Okay.
So there was a big interest of bringing my two worlds together. Actually, my first dance piece I ever created was called Hinky Punk in 2018 and kind of addressed my very early entrance into ballroom, the idea of competing, being in a battle, being in a ball, and the kind of the stress of that. And then, so this work, almost 10 years, I mean, it's 8 years since that.
Wow.
I've come back to ballroom now with all this knowledge I've had of building the scene here, founding a Kiki house, also being a mother of a Canadian mainstream house, House of Basquiat, Kiki House and House of Basalia. While also helping lead and support the new leaders of the community. It was really important for me to want to share to a new audience these kind of familial bonds that ballroom is really known for, but I think is kind of like the unspoken hero of the culture. So much of what people see about ballroom and voguing is like the glitz and the glam and what you see on the floor, on the runway, on the clip, on your socials, but so much of what gets us there is the family structure, the mother, father, the parental figures, your prince, princess, your godparents, all these kind of home mechanisms that help bring these moments forward in at a ball.
Okay, so I know a little bit about ballroom culture, but for somebody who doesn't know anything, how would you describe it? Because you did mention like the familial bond and sort of, you know, the mom, the dad, like there is that structure of the house. How would you describe ballroom culture to someone who is hearing it for the first time?
So ballroom is a culture that comes from the Black, Latinx, trans, and queer communities of Harlem, founding in the 60s. So historically, there's a tangent of it, of course, from the drag community. Crystal LaBeija famously was outraged by not winning in the documentary The Queen. So if you know, you know. Look at her makeup. It's terrible. And she started her own black and brown drag balls, which were really like queer, like drag pageants. So the format of ballroom today kind of continues that legacy of the pageant structure, but unlike Miss Universe, whatever, where everyone does the same category, in ballroom, all the categories are dispersed as individual events in itself. And then I think kind of really allows for different types of queerness to be celebrated. So it's not just about looking like wearing the evening gown, the swimsuit gown, Maybe like for me in the ballroom scene, I walk Butch Queen Vogue Femme, which is like the dancing category. Mm-hmm. Butch Queen is the alias for a gay cis man, and Vogue Femme is a style of voguing. And I also walk Small Boys European Runway, which is very much like Versace, Naomi Campbell walking runway.
Okay.
And that perpetuates now until this day. And yeah, you see it on TV, you see it on everywhere now.
Love, love, love it. Now, My House debuts at the Dance Center on June 19th and 20th for 8 p.m. shows both nights. And I'm curious, what are you most excited about when you think about My House?
Honestly, I'm just excited to bring amazing talent of the ballroom scene from around the country into a room We have an icon, Snoopy, now the mother of the House of FUBU. She just debuted her FUBU house in Toronto, shout out. So she'll be in town from Toronto. Father Jaws Siriano, who's also from Toronto, and legendary Besos 007 from Montreal will be the dancers in this work. Princess Peggy, Pink Lady, is on the mic. And my own daughter, Simone Vesalio, will also be DJing throughout the work. And I guess what I'm most curious about and excited around all of that is bringing ballroom audiences into the room, mixing them with the traditional or maybe the custom dance center audience, you know, which maybe doesn't know anything about ballroom, but hoping that the work can bridge, you know, these two communities together. And because a lot of work that I'm curious about and what I do and everything is really about bridging and connecting. And as I think it's the only way we can understand and get to know each other and care about each other more.
Absolutely. And I'm really excited. I plan on attending. I am super, super excited. I feel like your answer kind of segues into the next question that I have, which probably has a similar answer, but I'm going to ask it anyways. Why do you feel that my house is so important for us as the general, you know what I mean, Lower Mainland folks, right? Why should we come out and see my house?
I think so often we forget how connection and being in space together is truly powerful and like life-changing. Mm-hmm. And I really hope that by people seeing this work, they are reminded of that and also question their ideas of family and whether it be biological or chosen, and how important they are in how they can transform our lives, and how to nurture those relationships and that, yeah, you have to come at it with care, that there's nuance and that without those support systems, like or maybe not that without them, but that we are never really on our own,
right.
That there are always people around us that want and see it for us and want to push us and want to care and love us.
Love that. Now, we can get tickets by, I guess, visiting the Dance Center's website.
Yes.
I'm going to make sure that I include that website in the show notes.
And there's also an exhibit happening downstairs at the foyer of the Dance Center until Vancouver Pride that parallels the show. So there are archived objects, costumes, and a documentary actually by Simone Vesalio too. Showcasing the ballroom scene. So,
awesome.
Yeah, because similar to a family, you have like, you know, your hand-me-downs, you know,
yeah.
A dress goes here, it goes here. And so one of the parts of the wall is a didactic showing some of the history of some of the garments. And also we have an adjacent talk series, kind of like not as developed podcast,
yeah.
Kind of sharing the history, the different familial structures. So we had a talk with legendary Twisted and Tamar Miyake Mugler. They're the mother-father of the House of Miyake Mugler, but the mother and father role. Mm-hmm. We just had a talk recently in April with the prince and princesses of the scene. And later this June, we have a talk with the godparents of the Canadian ballroom scene.
I love it. Now, before I let you go, you are the founder of Fake Knot. Would you like to just give us a little inside, you know, peek as to your company?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So Fake Knot has been kind of an accumulation of all my training and my experience as a dancer, more formally founding it in 2018 after my first work. I come from many, many different dance backgrounds. So I started in breakdancing, got into contemporary dance and all the other street dance styles.
Okay.
Also do film and TV and all this stuff, and now learning flamenco.
Oh.
So Fake Knot has become really my way of funneling my curiosities and my multiple selves through this kind of alias. And more recently in the last few years, and I guess always, I love clothing, I love textile. I've been really anchored around like the visual aesthetic of how costume can create choreographic narrative, whether that be through an anthropologic route or a really tactile route, like my paper dress piece called Croaky. And or just like like Janet Jackson costume, you know, so
yes,
quite
yes.
A range. That's kind of my world, and it's been really interesting seeing it shift as I shift, as many artists do, and but also become more finite as I keep moving forward.
Yeah.
Thanks to Nicole and to Ralph Escamillan for that that interview about My House, which you can grab tickets for at thedancecenter.ca. Runs June 19th and 20th, Friday, Saturday, at the Dance Center, 677 Davie Street. There is a post-show artist talkback session as well on the Saturday, June 19th session. Thanks for listening to Speak Up this morning with me. Tomorrow in this time, we will be hearing Nukmi again as we feature it during National Indigenous Peoples Month. And next Monday on Speak Up with Magnus, there's a discussion about a BC Labor Relations Board report finding that Amazon has not been bargaining in good faith, creating an impasse in negotiations for a contract at its YVR distribution center. We'll also have another installment of Gardening with Embark with Pablo Vimas and more. So stick around for that coming up next here at CJSF. We've got Democracy Now!, but the whole day, the whole afternoon is great. We'll hear Beats and Eats with Nicole, who you just heard in that interview. We've got Call Me Negotiator. We've got Free Voices. We've got Analog Archives. We've got 60 Minute Stage Dive, The Arts Show. It's all good stuff, and it's all coming up here on CJSF. So thanks for hanging out with me this hour, and enjoy the rest of what today has to bring.
Good morning. This is your wake-up call.
But I didn't request
it. Liver disease affects 1 in 4 Canadians. It doesn't come with a warning. It doesn't wait for the right moment. It can happen to anyone at any time. While liver disease may be part of your story, it doesn't define it. Liver Canada is here for you before, during, and after diagnosis. Find resources, support, and hope at liver.ca. Liver Canada, by your side at